Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, and welcome to the Right Stream Radio Network. You are listening to Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. It is a rather nice late spring day here in Fairfax, Virginia. It's a little warm, it's a little muggy, and the thunderheads are starting to build up over the front range of the Blue Ridge Mountains, which means we're probably going to get a little bit of atmospheric excitement later in the day. But today we're going to go and do a slightly different show, a show with someone who is an old friend of this to this particular broadcast, and we're going to be talking about something involving my old friend, my partner, my co-author, and my mentor, Tom Clancy. As many of you know, Tom passed away last year, taking with him an unbelievable talent that most people will never know or understand. I had the pleasure of knowing him for over 20 years, and it's just a shame that voice has been silenced. But while his voice has been silenced, not all of the voices of his work have gone away. And I'm here to tell you this week is a joyous occasion, because for the first time in almost a decade, there's going to be a new volume, in fact, there is a new volume, of the Op Center series, which was a peripheral series developed by Tom and Steve Pachenik some years ago. And the new book is called Out of the Ashes. It is already a bestseller on several major book lists, and today we have one of the authors with us, George Galderisi, and sadly, we couldn't get Dick Couch because he's out doing other things today, as busy men who write books do, but he sends along his greetings as well. George, are you there, my friend?
I'm right here with you, John. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us again, and I'd like to start by just, for those of our listeners who missed the wonderful show that we did on the single photograph, The Kissing Sailor, some weeks ago. Tell listeners a little about yourself.
Well, no, thanks, John. I grew up in New York City, went to the Naval Academy, spent 30 years on active duty as a helicopter pilot, amphib guy, battle group guy. I worked for industry for a couple of years, and now I work for Space War Systems Center Pacific, which is the Navy's command and control lab up here in Point Loma. Started writing articles for professional journals in 1978, and quite frankly stumbled into writing books, nonfiction and fiction, quite by accident. Blessed to be teamed up with Dick Couch on several projects. One was the Act of Valor book, and now this Op Center series. So yeah, that's about the long and the short of it, John.
Now, it's worth saying, to be completely truthful, you and I share a lot of roots. You've worked around the Clancy franchises a bit. You and I also share a common publisher down in Florida, Faircount Media Group. We do articles for their website and have written a variety of things. So George and I have, shall we say, bounced off each other a few times, and this is going to be one of those fun times because, for once, we're not talking about something real. We're talking about going back into the world of the contrived and the novel. And I guess that takes me to my first question. Is this the first novel you've done, or is this a new adventure into fiction that you've never done before?
No, thanks for asking, John. Dick and I have both written novels in the past. Dick's initial novel, SEAL Team One, I think was probably the best SEAL novel ever written. It was some years ago. I started writing novels in the late 90s under the Avon, then HarperCollins imprint with first Carnotta Conspiracy and then For Duty and Honor. And then teamed up with Dick quite serendipitously to do the novelization of the Bandito Brothers Relativity Media movie Act of Valor, which came out about 2 years ago. So that's when Dick and I first started to partner. And then due to the success of Act of Valor, our agent John Silbersack at Trident Media Group, I'll use the word auditioned us for this to restart this Op Center series. And it turned out they gave us a shot, and we're happy to be doing it.
Let's also talk a little bit about our mutual friend Dick Couch. I know him, of course, as a writer about special operations, who's worked for me on my Year in Special Operations books, has been one of the grand deans of the nonfiction historical telling of stories around the special forces, SEALs, you name it. What other things do you care to add to your co-author's resume for our listeners?
Well, you know, I could fill the rest of your show just saying great things about Dick. Like I said, I'm blessed. Dick's been writing a little longer than I have, so I'm blessed to be teamed with him. Dick's got about a dozen and a half books, as you said, John, both fiction and nonfiction. I think the most noteworthy thing in all of his writing is, as you suggested, I would say Dick Couch knows more about special operations than probably anyone alive in or out of uniform. And why do I say that? Dick has embedded with each of the various segments of our special operations community, first the SEALs, then the Army, and most recently the Marine Corps. And by embedded, I mean lived and worked with them for 6 to 8 months at a time. To do his most recent book on the Marine Corps, he moved to Camp Lejeune and got to know those folks. So in writing those nonfiction books. So he, like I said, he brings a wealth of knowledge from firsthand experience, not from, you know, any other secondary sources. So so that's what I think is most unique about Dick, that he did it right. He embedded with the folks and learned their trade.
And as someone who has worked in some of the places where he's been and around some of the things he's done, it's the only way the special ops guys will ever even begin to allow you into their world, much less trust you. And Dick is, I think, the shining light in journalism and in the book business in terms of his respect from within the community itself. And that's a rare, rare thing in this world. There's a third player here, a player who can't talk for himself because of his passing last year, and that's our mutual friend Tom Clancy. Tom, we lost last year to a heart attack almost a year ago now, and he created a writing of style that so many of us have dealt in at various levels during our writing careers. Talk a little bit about both the shadow and the influence of Clancy on your own career and how you have used that body of work and that reputation that he's had to create this new book.
Sure. No, I, you know, as military, and again, I just wanted to pile on to your last comment about Dick, John. What some of your listeners might not know is the reason Dick has the street creds to do what he's done writing-wise, he is a former Navy SEAL. He led the only successful POW rescue in Vietnam as a Navy SEAL. Then he went to work for the CIA. So from a street creds perspective, he's right on top. But addressing your question directly, I mean, as military guys, I think it's fair to say Dick and I devoured everything that Tom Clancy has written from his first book, Hunt for Red October, and watched that series grow. And then we watched the Op Center and Net Force series, which you described, again, as an adjunct to his mainline books. And, you know, you sort of get absorbed in that body of work and it becomes part of your DNA. But to deconstruct it a little, obviously we didn't want to, you know, try to mimic Tom's wonderful books. But of all the things he's done so well in fiction, the thing that struck us that we wanted to highlight in Op Center was being prescient. I think if you read all of the obituaries for Tom, John, including the wonderful one you wrote for Defense Media Network, the ones in the New York Times and elsewhere, they pointed out dramatically that the things that Tom Clancy wrote about 5 years, 10 years down the pike, people look back and they said, wow, that really happened. So that's what we're putting into the DNA of the Op Center series. We want to write something that we believe is going to happen in intelligence and terrorism and military operations and have people look back years from now and say, hey, those guys are right.
We'll talk a little more about that part of the work later in the show. But I also wanted to bring up one other thing about Tom, and I think that anybody who writes and writes fiction has to deal with, is that you have to believe, you have to create believable characters. And the one thing I always dealt with, Tom, whether it was in person or professionally or from a distance, everything about Tom was personal. When people say it's business, it's not personal. No, Tom, it was always personal with Tom, and so it was with his characters. They were believable, tactile, interesting people, usually with marvelous and devious flaws built in.
Right, and I think, you know, to that point, John, that's what Dick and I focused on very intensely in the Op Center series. I mean, it'd be wonderful if everyone in America, everyone in the world read your books and thought they were fabulous, but we feel our primary audience that we have to satisfy is current and former military guys. In other words, if the characters are not believable, if they're military people, then those folks won't read the books. In fact, they'll throw them away. So that was we worked very hard on that, making sure that those characters were believable, that people could relate to them and actually enjoy being with them.
For those who may or may not be familiar with the original Op Center series of books, when it finished up in its first run almost a decade ago, where was the series and where was the storyline for those who may or may not be familiar with it?
Okay, so for your listeners, John, the Op Center series created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik started in 1995. Finished in 2005. There were 12 books, so about a little more than a book a year. And in the last few books, Op Center was coming under increasing fire. Things were not going well. People were getting fired, and it sort of looked like Op Center was winding down and not being a vital part of national security. So that's where it was left. The series, of course, started before 9/11, and so many other things have changed in the intelligence and the terrorism and the military operations community. So we rebooted the series, keeping faith to the Op Center concept, but it's a new Op Center in a new location with new characters and a similar mission, but a similar mission to protect the nation done in a different way.
And we'll talk a little more about how you did that here later on. Let's talk a little bit about, though, the bureaucratic process that went into going and restarting it. And for our listeners, if you'd like to talk to George or myself, you can call in. Our number for call-ins is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246, and we'll try and get you on the air. Obviously, the series came to an end in 2005, and somewhere here recently, the nice folks at St. Martin's Press, who I've, again, in the interest of transparency, I've written two books for and deeply enjoyed the experience. But St. Martin's made the decision to acquire this property. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that acquisition and the team that was put together, including yourself and Dick, to execute this new series of books.
Sure, John. No, happy to. To be honest with you, Dick and I love to write so much. That's the reason we have an agent, John Silversack at Trident Media Group. So, you know, I got a call from John's assistant, asked Dick and I to get on a conference call with John, and John floated this possibility, said, you know, I've auditioned you guys with Steve Pachenik and with his agent, Mel Berger, and with St. Martin's Press, and they think they might want to go forward with you. Let's have a big conference call. So a couple of weeks later we did with all the players you mentioned and more and talked about our concept for the series, and they thought about it and came back to us with a contract to do to restart the series. So, yeah, I guess it didn't seem bureaucratic to us. It seemed wonderful to us, although I know as you know, John, from your writing, at the agent and publisher level, there's talk that has to go on, but I think it all turned out. We're delighted to be with St. Martin's. Our editor, Charlie Spicer, just makes the stuff we write a lot better, so we're pretty much happy as bats right now.
I spoke with Mr. Spicer early today, and he indicated that the entire process of putting the team together was calm, was logical, and unlike some, you know, difficult negotiations or anything else, this one went smoothly, quietly, and went forward without a lot of drama. What was the writing experience like working with St. Martin's? I mean, what had been your previous experience with their imprint, and what did you like best about this experience?
Well, I didn't have any prior experience with St. Martin's. I'd had the other eight books I'd done with other publishers, but it was pretty straightforward, John. We had a contract that specified a due date and a length for the book. And you know, not to tell you how sausage is made, but I'm a helicopter pilot for 30 years, and you live by a NATOPS checklist, so I'm a little linear that way. So we just did a very thorough treatment with a high concept with lots of stuff in it. I guess the treatment was over 10,000 words with sketches of all the characters, and we did a narrative outline again, probably more towards 15,000 words, with a chapter by chapter breakdown of what we did, and we shipped that to our editor Charlie Spicer for approval, and he said, "I like it. Go forward with that." So it was just a question of execution at that point. But and again, as you know from your writing, it didn't rigidly follow the outline. As you got deeper into the book, things change, characters morph, characters arc. But like I said earlier, not to make Charlie blush, when we threw it over the transom to Charlie and got his edits back, they were fabulous edits. They were things that we said, gee, we should have thought of that, and they were all helpful. So it went very smoothly.
Before you and Dick did the outline, had you been given a Bible or a master plot line that you were to follow, or were you left to your own devices to put this together?
No, I think it's more the latter, John. Again, when we had that major conference call that I described earlier with the people at St. Martin's with Steve Pachenik, that was one of the things that Dick and I raised. Would their expectation be that we just reinstitute Op Center from the original series completely as is and have all the same characters carry on? And they said we weren't bound to that, and then that was expressed and evidenced in the treatment and the narrative outline we sent them. So that was we had tremendous freedom. I think it would have been difficult, not impossible, but difficult for us to just restart the series with exactly the same characters, with exactly the same functions, et cetera, et cetera. I think it would have disappointed readers.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that, again, those new characters and the new op center itself. I guess the final question is one that a lot of writers wonder, and that is, you know, you and I share a common thread that we've both done a lot of collaborative books. I've worked with Tom, Norm Pollmar, Dwight Zimmerman, among others. How was, you know, and in the best cases, they're like a good marriage. How was the marriage with Dick Couch? What kind of a writer is he to work with?
Well, let me put it this way. We wouldn't be partnered up if we both didn't find the other person easy to work with. I know that almost sounds like pablum, but it's not. I think I want to go back, if I may, John, to describe that or explain that, going back to the Act of Valor book. The Act of Valor book was a novelization of an already done movie. We'd seen the movie once. We got the screenplay. We were under tremendous time constraints. So that one was pretty much a kludge. In other words, we divided it up. Dick, you write these chapters. George, you write these chapters. We put them together, edited each other's work. And again, not to get off on a tangent, but of all the compliments we got about that book, the most important one to us was people who knew us would say, I couldn't tell who wrote what part. So
yeah.
With that sort of emergency writing under our belts, I think we had a good feel for who would be best writing what part. And so once I did we did the treatment and then a narrative outline, and Charlie Spicer at St. Martin's approved it, Dick and I divided the chapters up, but we had plenty of time to edit each other's work, make suggestions, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think not to tell you too much, but if there's a difference, it's I enjoy the outlining part the most. I like doing the treatment. I like doing the narrative outline. I like the writing. Dick enjoys the writing most. So I think if we counted words and who wrote which words, Dick probably wrote a few more words than I did. But it would give us good division of labor.
And that takes us to another question, and that is, in terms of the writing and the smoothing out and all the other things that go with putting together a collaborative work, what are your biggest challenges in that part of it? I mean, I've worked with some challenging individuals, particularly Tom himself, who I was just very much a rookie author when I worked with him. You guys know your business. You guys know how to do this. Is this two professionals coming together, shaking hands, and just starting to let the chips fly? What sort of relationship do you wind up happening at the end of this book with Dick?
Well, I think the two words that come to mind are trust and professional respect. In other words, when we divide up chapters, we trust each other to deliver them on time with a high quality, and just professional respect is that Dick knows what I do best from my military background and the kind of work I'm doing today, and I know what he does best. So there weren't any I imagine in some collaborations that one writer takes some stuff, the other writer takes the other stuff, and then there's that stuff in the middle that no one wants to do and they sort of argue about. We didn't have any of those.
Really?
We didn't fight not to do stuff, and we didn't fight to do stuff. And again, I'm not saying this to flatter Dick, but Dick's been doing this a little longer than I have. He's got more novels under his belt, so I would defer to him if he said, well, you know, I think I should take this one. I go like, okay, that makes sense. So, but yeah, it just kind of fell into place, John. It wasn't, we didn't have to hire a mediator. Let me put it that way.
Your wives didn't have to go and pry you apart with crowbars or anything. Very good.
Yeah.
We're going to go and take a quick break here for some network messages. And when we come back here, I'd like to go and talk more about this new ops center and how you laid it out, how you built the new ops center, if that's okay. All right. And for our listeners, this is the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network. Rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rightstream and hashtag Rightstream. Thanks for listening to the Rightstream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network. Tune in to host Daria Ann for Rightstream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Rightstream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Rightstream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Rightstream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Rightstream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. And so we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can. But we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's wireless companies, and the National Safety Council.
And welcome back. This is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. And we're talking today with... Excuse me, just a minor problem here. We're talking with George Galdiali, and we're talking about his new book, Out of the Ashes with Dick Couch. It's the first of the new Op Center books. And George, are you there with me?
Still with you, John. Thank you.
Excuse me there. Had a little problem with one of the buttons. As we like to say, it's a loose nut in front of the keyboard. Anyway, let's talk a little about how you go and build a new Op Center 10 years, or in this particular case, almost 20 after it was originally created. Because we really are talking about you having to construct a physical entity in your minds. The old facility, which was, I believe, out at Andrews Air Force Base at one point, now has a new home. You've got new characters with a few ties to the old ones. Let's go down and run that down for the listeners, what you had to do. And the first one is, what were the conditions that existed in your world there that caused the president to decide, I need a new Op Center? Run the listeners through that.
Well, thank you, John. The way we set up the book is a crisis occurs, and a terrorist attack occurs in the United States. After the attack, and you know, when they do the forensics after the attack, they found out that, as President Obama said some years ago with the underwear bomber incident, we failed to connect the dots. So when the president took office, one of the things he had been briefed on was the existence of an op center in a previous administration. That was something that they just put on the shelf, and then when this attack occurred and they realized that the normal levers of national security hadn't prevented the attack, he said, let's think about reinstituting Op Center. So that's how we set that transition up in the book.
And in doing so, you obviously have a number of characters that you have to develop, but you also have to provide a little bit of a tie back to the old Op Center. Which characters did you preserve, and what was their role in creating this? And it's worth noting to our listeners that you, when we talked over the weekend about this, you said that literally constructing Op Center and its new team takes about a third of the total book.
Well, yeah, John. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know the old center, the old Op Center series had sold millions and millions of books, was a bestseller, and there was a core readership. So our first thought was, if this thing is brand new with no connection back to the old Op Center, those readers aren't going to be engaged. They're going to go, well, this isn't for me. I was the old Op Center person, and now this new one's there. So it had to kind of make sense. So The way we set it up is, of course, Paul Hood was the director of Op Center for the series, and he had his assistant, his military assistant. We brought them back as part of that transition. So here's how we set it up. This tragedy I described happened. The president called in his chief of staff and asked for the Op Center file. He read it, While he was doing that, Paul Hood was prescient enough to realize that had Op Center still been around, they might have sniffed out this this attack and done something about it. So he was then called by the president's chief of staff and asked to come in for an interview. So he called his former deputy. He had lunch with his former deputy in Annapolis, and said, "Gee, I've been asked to do this. What do you think?" And they talked about it and decided that it was the right thing to do. Paul Hood, of course, was a patriot, and he wanted to do the right thing. And without giving away the entirety of the first third of the book, there were we describe in the book good and sufficient reasons why Paul Hood could not be that person. So when the president pulled him in to interview him to talk about restarting an Op Center and go through the pros and cons, and finally Paul Hood convinced him that Op Center is something that should be restarted, the president said, "Well, we want you to do it." And Paul Hood said, "I can't do it for these reasons." But he had someone waiting in the Eisenhower Executive Office building, and he said, "Mr. President, if I can't do this, but I've taken the liberty of bringing someone along who could, I feel, is eminently qualified to lead this. Would you like to meet him?" And so the new director, Chase Williams, interviewed with the president, and the president decided right there that he was the guy.
So right there, you provide a really tangible connection with the old series and the new one and make what we like to call a very adroit handoff. You also talked about having to go and recruit an entire cast of new characters and not necessarily as direct replacements. As a matter of fact, and we'll take this a little further later in the segment, you actually go and recruit a very different kind of team of people than the original Op Center had in its functions in the early series. Talk a little bit about some of those recruits and what kind of people you were looking for or creating out of your minds.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to, John. I think to segue into that, though, I think it's important that, you know, as Dick and I conceived this, there were so many things that changed from 1995 when the series was first introduced that we felt we needed to address. I mean, the whole notion of civilian control of the military, the tension between the government, the military, and the intelligence communities, technology-enabled tension between counterterrorism efforts and civil liberties. There are issues that are too hot to handle for the Department of Defense, Department of State, and that, above all else, Op Center had to get ahead of the problem. So they had to do what you're very familiar with, John, in Colonel John Boyd's OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act. They had to get inside the new enemy's OODA loop. So to do that, and again, we're indebted to Steve Pachenik, the co-creator of this series, who still today works in the intelligence world, for coining the phrase for us, anticipatory intelligence. So,
and that's a really
again,
big
we know
concept.
What's changed in the military today. Information is now a weapon. It's not an enabler. It's a weapon. So I guess the theme there is that information rules. So to address your question directly now, the part of Op Center is composed because, remember, they're going to need to work with military units in the U.S. military. So the core people who are the J-1, the J-2, the J-3 kind of people in Op Center, by and large, are former military people, often special operators. But the core of Op Center, and I guess the special sauce in Op Center, is their intelligence directorate. And to recruit the right people for that who could get the human out of the loop to let the intelligence algorithms run, Chase Williams recruited people from Silicon Valley. He recruited people from eBay and from Amazon and from Google and from the high-tech companies, and all of these are young people. They're people you would never envision working for the military, so you know, as you go through the book, there's some initial tension of people from Silicon Valley showing up and, you know, being asked to wear grown-up clothes and being told that they can't walk across the street and go surfing, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a fun part of the book, is integrating those new professionals, young professionals, into a what was a previously, you know, top-down military organization.
So you've got, if you will, what used to be called a long hair component being mixed with the short hair military and intelligence people. And, of course, this provides a wonderful series of plot devices for you to go and create tension and build relationships, correct?
Well, I guess, you know, not to make it a bumper sticker, but it's if you think of the baby boomers and the millennials having a shotgun wedding and being told they're going to live and work together, I think that's that might kind of sum it up.
Nicely said, sir. That's good, George. I may steal that one. Now, in addition, you've gone and made a conscious decision about going and moving the Ops Center from its old location to a brand new facility. And there's a good reason for it that most people don't know. Please explain the place and explain the reason.
No, thanks. So one of the things, of course, that changed after 9/11 was a complete revamp of the national intelligence community, which previously was 16 separate and distinct agencies just kind of doing their own thing, CIA, DIA, NRO. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with those acronyms. Then after 9/11, that was all put under the aegis of the Director of National Intelligence, and, of course, General Clapper is the current director. And so we felt Ops Center would be well served if they leveraged what the intelligence community provided and actually lived with in the same location with what we considered the most cutting-edge portion of the intelligence community. Again, this is our opinion. I don't want to get in a turf war with anyone who works for one of the other agencies, but we felt the NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, was the best. And part of the reason we chose that is just through our day work and people we know, it seems like most smart, brilliant young people who want to work for national intelligence seem to gravitate towards NGA. They have got, as you know, John, from living in the area, they've got the coolest-looking building of any intelligence up there in Fort Belvoir North. I'm sure you've been in and around there. And so we constructed, in the book, we constructed a basement underneath the NGA where Ops Center had their new home, and that way they could leverage a lot of the high-power computing assets, a lot of the top-secret and above facilities there without having to build everything from whole cloth. I will hesitate to add, though, they're separate and distinct from NGA. They don't fall under NGA's direction, but as opposed to picking a location in Kansas or somewhere else, that seemed to be the most logical one. And the other part of it is to be we knew Ops Center was an independent agency, but someone that had to work with the president and others in the executive branch. So we wanted it to be close enough to the White House and the Pentagon and all those places to for the director and others to get there, but not so close that people were walking by every day saying, "What are you doing?"
And, of course, there's the question of pipes. Information is like water. It takes a certain size pipe to move vast amounts of it. And NGA arguably has the biggest pipes in the world supporting their distribution of documents, assessments, photos, maps, and all the other stuff they do. So in reality, if you were going to do this in real life, it's not a bad place to choose.
No, and the other thing we like, and again, the Ops Center is attracting young, brilliant people who are in, you know, high-speed, high-tech industries like Google and Amazon. And think about what NGA used to be, John. You know, way back when they were the Defense Mapping Agency. Would you like to go to recruiting?
Oh, yeah. I've got a lot of those old maps in my files.
Would you like to go to a recruiting fair and say, hey, young fella, how'd you like to work for the Defense Mapping? It just doesn't sound cool. And that's important to millennials and Gen Xers and Gen Y. I mean, they want to work someplace that's really cool. So for us, NGA was it, and Ops Center became it, that Chase Williams was able to hire these people from Silicon Valley and, quite frankly, pay them, as I think we phrased it in the book, pay them salaries that the Government Accountability Office would think were obscene because they needed the talent that much.
A lot of GS 13s, 14s, and 15s in the bunch, huh?
Not so much. A lot of people making more money than most senior executives and flag officers.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit now about the story, the actual storyline, because you have, along with Ms. Dick Couch, come up with a rather intriguing thought, and that is, right now, what we are used to here in the West are attacks being carried out, particularly suicide attacks, by young men, usually with IQs well below normal, who have been either radicalized or have other problems. I mean, we can't help but think about the underwear bomber and a lot of the Hamas-type terrorists who go and, you know, you make themselves into human bombs. But you guys are thinking that that trend is going to change because there's a glut of a certain, shall we say, skill set pool out there in the world, and that they need employment. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, sure. And again, we don't want to negate the fact that in the world today there are young disenfranchised men, some women, who become angry and agitated jihadists and you know, can be convinced to wear a suicide vest and wreak havoc. But I think we need to give the levers of national security, particularly the Department of Homeland Security, credit that America as a country has become hardened since then, and we've cut off many, not all, but many of the avenues for that angry person with a vest to get into a shopping mall or something like that. So we feel the people who would do us harm, be they government entities, be they non-governmental entities, be they just some outraged person, they're gonna contract killers to get us. They're gonna have to find someone, again, as you described, John, with a lot higher than that low IQ person who's a jihadi, perhaps. They're going to have to find someone with the skill set and the experience to do a contract kind of killing. So that's where we feel the new face of terrorism, again, not exclusively, but one that you need an op center to address because it goes beyond the bounds of our normal levers of national security.
So in other words, you're re-embracing in some very real ways the kind of character that Freddie Forsyth created, God, half a century ago, in Day of the Jackal.
Yes, I think that's a very apt description, but I would say one armed with more money and more experience in doing those sorts of things.
And when you say that, you are referring, of course, to the legions of military contractors around the world who have taken up the cause of fighting many of the world's wars and providing much of the protection and security for governments around the planet. And as we all know, supply and demand is a real thing, including in the job market.
Well, no, you're right, John. And again, without getting into, you know, political political sidebars and stuff like that, if you look at what's happening in the Ukraine today, the people agitating against the Ukrainian government are not, you know, not some college student who doesn't have anything to do that Tuesday. You know, you look at what they're doing and how they're conducting themselves, and these are, you know, former military or former Russian mafia guys. And so that's where we, you know, where we think the new threat to the nation is these kind of highly talented, highly sophisticated people who would do us harm.
And let's not kid ourselves, with Iraq and Afghanistan and the conflicts there in somewhat decline, there's a bunch of these guys running around who are unemployed or underemployed.
Well, I'm not sure the direction of your question, but I think if you're suggesting former U.S. military people would do that, I guess we didn't go there. The people who are doing us harm are people who grew up in other places or had no connection with the U.S. military, who are the people who are trying to do us in both the first book, Out of the Ashes, and then our follow-on books.
Indeed, although certainly that option does exist for you down the road. You can take, as you said, St. Martin's has been very generous in terms of allowing you to take the series where you want to go and to do with it what you can. And to that degree, I'm not going to ruin ruin the ending for everybody who needs to go out and buy this book. And by the way, it's a fine book. But in your opinion, what's your favorite part of the book? Is there a particular story or is there a particular scene or vignette that you really go back and you like the work you did on that? You like how you contrived that scene. Give us an example of one of the things from the book that you really enjoyed doing.
Oh, no, thanks for that. Well, I think, you know, part of our focus, as I mentioned earlier, John, was we felt the Op Center series had to sing for the core readership that made the first series so popular. But we also are mindful that the majority of people who read fiction are women, and that young people have found, particularly with being able to get books online, a new joy in reading. So the one part we're proud of is what I mentioned earlier was the geek tank, as we call it, those young people who comprise the core of Op Center's intelligence community, those former eBay, Amazon, you name it, workers. But then in this book, we introduce two female characters. One, based on my experience as a helicopter pilot, I was just reading an article in our local San Diego paper today that in the Navy fighter and attack community, I think something less than 3% of the pilots are women, whereas in our naval helicopter community, it's pushing double digits. So,
really?
Yes, sir. So one of the characters we have in the book is a Navy helicopter pilot woman, and she plays a prominent role in this book, and I'll hint in follow-on books. And then the other female character we have is a former enlisted Marine who served in Afghanistan as on the teams that went into towns, and because of the Afghan culture, men couldn't.
Oh, the female engagement teams, the FETs.
Exactly. She did that. She got out. She went to work for the Center for Naval Analysis, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And
my best friend Mike Markowitz works at CNA, yes.
There you go. Anyway, she is embarked in an Aegis cruiser as a CNA analyst. And again, from my military background, that's something we do routinely on deployments. And because she's an analyst.
Oh, so she's a field rep for CNA on board a cruiser. Excellent.
Exactly. When things happen, the officers on the ship, who are not exclusively but primarily men and older, jump to one conclusion about the information. Because of her background and training at CNA, she doesn't jump to conclusions. She analyzes the information. She shares it with a former colleague who works at the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, and they determine that the attack the United States is about to make on another country is based on bogus information, and she can't get anyone to believe that, so she gets in league with the helicopter pilot, and again, without spoiling the book for your readers, they uncover the plot in a rather dramatic way.
Obviously, the realities of modern media are apparent to all of us in the writing business. Do you have any depictions of social media, or for that matter, mainstream media in your book that have any, shall we say, bite or editorial quality to them?
Not prominently. Not prominently, John. There's a part towards the end of the book where another attack's about to happen in the United States, where the contract killer about to do this is very prominently on social media and communicating with his handlers far away via the internet, and I think that modernizes the story that, you know, it's not a dead drop in Central Park or something like that. It's you know, using the internet against us, communicating and using some social media, but we haven't featured it dramatically in the first book. But a great idea for follow-on books. Thank you.
And with that, we're coming to the end of the show, but let's lay it clear. This book is right now on a rocket to the moon. You're already on two bestseller lists and waiting to see what first week sales look like on Amazon. This book's doing extremely well. What I got from the folks at St. Martin's Press this morning is that they are very, very happy with you.
Well, obviously, as writers, we're happy. They're happy. You know, if you're a writer and people don't read what you write, you usually stop writing, I guess. But no, we're Dick and I. Not to tell you too much, we shipped our manuscript for the second book to Charlie Spicer about 3 weeks ago. Just several days ago, we received, and again, not to make Charlie blush, we received 6 pages of wonderful edits, and we're going through those now to tune it up. And I think St. Martin's is looking to put the second book out in May. And again, building on the first book and keeping Ops Center as a vital part of the national security apparatus.
And Charlie told me that I was allowed to say this on the air, that this is only, you know, these are only two of what are already contracted to be a four-book series. You've got a couple of busy years ahead of you.
Well, I think Dick and I wouldn't be doing this if we didn't love to write. It's one of our, both of us, I'll just flat say it, it's my primary hobby. I'm not very good at golf. Dick has other pursuits, but he loves writing too. Not to tell you too much, but Dick did a wonderful article. We're both Naval Academy graduates, did a wonderful article for our alumni magazine, Shipmate, over 2 years ago. The title of the article was So You Want to Be a Writer, and it was kind of a cautionary tale if you wanted to embark on a writing career, but bottom line, at the end of the article, he said, I can remember it like I read it yesterday, some people want to die with their boots on, he said, but for me, bury me with my word processor, I may wake up and want to write about it.
Interesting point. What other projects outside of the Ops Center world do you have in mind over the next couple of years?
I think right now, from a book perspective, the Ops Center project is intense enough, John, that book-wise, that's absorbing the major part of our focus. Dick and I both write articles for professional magazines, and as you mentioned, for Chuck Oldham's Defense Media Network. So other than books, the main writing outlet that I'm doing right now is just writing articles about intelligence, military, command and control, those sorts of matters.
George, I want to thank you for coming on the show again. It's always a pleasure. Congratulations on a great first week, and I'm sure you're going to have a few other good ones this year. Please come back and talk to us again anytime you get a notion, and I hope this works as well as it looks like it's going to.
Well, thank you, John, for having us on the show, and we'd be delighted to join you anytime downstream.
Thanks, George, and have a great week.
Thank you, John.
And that was George Galderisi, who, along with Dick Couch, has written Out of the Ashes, which is the first new book of the revised Op Center series from St. Martin's Press. And with that, we are coming to the end of another edition of Military Monday. We'll be back next week. We'll be talking about another military subject. But before we leave, I want to go and pay tribute to a good friend who passed away recently. Mo Morgan was an Air Force fighter pilot. He loved to fly. And when he stopped flying, he loved to go and war game. Wargaming and simulation was more than just a passion to Mo Morgan. He fought for its adoption within the Air Force and the military, sometimes to his personal detriment. He created businesses and designed games and took just an incredible joy in doing it. He networked like nobody else in our business. And I sadly got the news this last week that he had passed away way too young and way too soon. We'll all remember Mo Morgan, and I hope you'll go say a prayer for my friend and perhaps go and spend a little time thinking about those who behind the scenes help make us more ready when the bad things come. And with that, I'm going to call it a day. Hope you have a great week. Take care, and come back again and listen to us on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop. Took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man about Yeah.